Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
All the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison. Are you going to listen to me? Or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I am Josh Parcell, the founder, the host of College Football Country. Awesome, awesome show coming up for you guys today. Matt Mershell from the Orlando Sentinel is going to join me in just a little bit. He talked to Justin Fuente after spring practice about the Hokies' upcoming season, the pressure that's on him, and just what we should expect from this Virginia Tech team in a messy ACC Coastal. So we'll talk to him in just a little bit. First up, though, I am going to talk to my buddy from Charlotte, the Charlotte Observer, Marcel Louis Jacques. He used to write for Orange and White, a huge, huge Clemson insider for a long time, and he knows the program very well. Dabo Swinney getting paid that $93 million 10-year contract. So I'm going to talk to Marcel about, does this shut the door on Dabo Swinney going to Alabama? Is this a foregone conclusion now? He is a Tiger for a long time. And if so, who are some of the names that could potentially be the replacement for Nick Saban? If it's not Dabo, who could it be? So we'll talk to Marcel. We'll talk to Matt. It's going to be an awesome show. Make sure you guys download the podcast. Of course, if you're listening now, you're subscribing. Hopefully, you're telling your buddies about it. Make sure you follow me on Twitter at Josh Parcell for more college football talk all year long. So thanks again for listening. Right now, we turn it over to my buddy, Marcel Louis Jacques. Now of the Charlotte Observer, but formerly of the Greenville News and the Orange and White editor for the Independent Mail, Marcel Louis Jacques, good friend of mine who now we get to talk Panthers all the time, but I figured we would take a step back, go back in time for a minute and relive your Clemson days if you wanted to, Marcel. I know they're a fun team to cover, I'm sure.
Yeah, man, they're a ton of fun to cover. Great guys in the locker room, great talent on the field. I mean, you just saw that in the NFL draft this past week. I think six guys taken, and three of them by the same team. So apparently somebody thinks so.
I mean, they really have pulled even with Alabama, and in some cases they've even pulled ahead of them. I mean, you saw what happened in January. And it's funny, Marcel, because I wrote about a year and a half ago on College Football Country, I wrote, Clemson is the next Alabama. And it felt like the reason I said that was not because I felt like Alabama was going anywhere, but because Dabo has modeled a lot of what he does after Alabama. I think he's fun Alabama in a way. And he's doing it in a conference that, and maybe you'll push back on me on this, because I know some people like to defend the ACC tooth and nail. It's a more winnable league than the SEC. And when you have all the resources that you have at Alabama, yet you're in a league that doesn't quite have the same sort of competitive environment, not to say there aren't good teams, but it's not as deep as the SEC. It feels like Dabo is in a spot now where he's built to succeed and win championships for a long time to come.
I think so, and I like what you said about fun Alabama, because that's what you kind of get the gist of it there. That Alabama, it's more of a business. You know, you come in, you put your work in, it's run by this taskmaster, Nick Saban, and then Clemson's more the fun. They got, you know, a slide in the building and volleyball courts and mini golf and whatnot on the facility as well outside. And another thing about them, like it feels like more of a family environment. I really can't speak for the lack of a family environment at Alabama, but when you have the quality assistants that Clemson has, who are being sought after every single year for a head coaching job, yet they still stay in place, then you have to wonder, okay, there's got to be something more going on there behind the scenes that we don't see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that doesn't get talked about enough. Is just that continuity on the staff. I mean, a lot of successful programs are able to maintain a core of that staff for a long time. Alabama loses guys every single year, and to their credit, it hasn't slowed them down. I mean, they're continuing to dominate, but Clemson has been able to do this with the same group of guys, and I think that's really, really great. I mean, they did lose Chad Morris a handful of years ago, but they've kept Tony Elliott, they've kept Jeff Scott, like they've kept these guys on both sides of the ball. It's been huge for them. The reason I got you on is because, you know, we want to talk about that contract. I mean, Dabo gets this 10-year, $93 million deal, and, you know, it's eye-popping. It's a huge number, but you look at the impact, the financial impact he has had on that university, on that athletic department, and of course, just where it stacks up against the rest of the country. To me, I think he's worth every penny. How did you feel when you saw that number?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, your first thought is just, wow, like, it's $93 million. It looks like a player's contract, man. Yeah. But, of course, NFL players, not college
players. Anywhere close to the college players.
Exactly. But, but you look at the financial impact that he's had, not just on their athletic programs, but that brings in football interest, brings in academic interest. Because I guarantee you, people from California are applying to Clemson before Dabo starts winning 10 games a year and they start winning national championship games. Property values have gone up in the area because people want to be around. People want to have that fall home and winter home to go watch football. So I think he's worth every penny. And I thought it was also interesting that the clause that they put in there, the buyout, I guess, when the ads, I think an extra $1.5 million or $2 million, depending on the year, if he were to leave Clemson for Alabama.
When you saw that, so people reacted one or two different ways. Some people said, okay, there's an added buyout. This shuts the door. There's no way he's going to Alabama. And then there's the other side of the coin where people look at it and say, well, Clemson had to put this in there. They know how real the threat is that he could leave for Alabama. I mean, how realistic is it that you think that whenever Saban steps down, that he does in fact go home to Alabama immediately after Saban?
Immediately after? I just don't think so. I think that he's built Clemson up from, it might as well be the ground floor when he first got there. So I think that is a sense of pride. But you just never know, because you know, some people get tired of, or they feel like they're not challenged anymore, and so would like a different kind of challenge. But I think they're very established in Clemson and in South Carolina. But obviously, Clemson wouldn't include that if they didn't think it was a very realistic possibility. I think it's possible. I just don't think it happens. I think that he stays at Clemson for a very long time. I don't think that anybody necessarily wants to follow Saban anyway.
Yeah.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Exactly. And it's interesting from the Alabama standpoint, because there's not an obvious name out there that makes perfect sense other than Dabo. I mean, he's kind of the one in 1A if you're Alabama about who could be the next guy. I'll get to that part of it in a second. But as far as Dabo is concerned, and could he be the guy to replace Saban? This reminds me a lot of Roy Williams in Carolina, because Roy was the name, you know, when Dean Smith stepped down, he was the name that was thrown out there, but Dean wanted Guthridge to get the job. So Bill Guthridge takes it for 3 years, and then Guthridge retires. And then Roy's name really surfaces and he turns the job down. Everybody wanted Roy to leave Kansas, come home to Carolina, didn't do it. Matt Daugherty comes in, the program runs into the ground, they win 8 games, he gets fired a year later, and then Roy takes the job finally on that third try. To me, it feels kind of like what you were saying. I don't know that I'm almost positive Dabo does not take this job immediately after Saban, most importantly because he's got such a good thing going, he doesn't need to leave. He's already got an equal, if not better, program, but it feels like whoever takes over for Saban, they're not doing what Saban did. I mean, nobody is. That's an impossible standard. So it almost feels like, hey, let the next guy come in and tick off all of Tuscaloosa because he doesn't win a national title every other year, and then Dabo can kind of come save the program maybe once he's 12, 15 years secured at Clemson or more, I guess, in that case. And maybe he's that guy that's where he finishes his career.
I would be – if he's going to Alabama, I would say it's that latter scenario. Rather than, like we said, immediately following Nick Saban. It just, there's nothing, it's almost like a lose-lose for him there. Like, either you always get compared to Saban or you never live up to that. And Dabo is a good coach, and he's built a great system at Clemson around him. I'm not going to say that he is a product of his assistants, but they have a heavy, like, that matters.
Oh, yeah.
What Jeff Scott, Tony Elliott, Brent Venables, Brendan Streeter, what these guys are able to do behind the scenes, it absolutely matters, and they're excellent recruiters. I don't think all of them are following him to Alabama, so it would be a different challenge for him to assemble a new staff and whatnot. But I don't know. Like, it would be interesting. I like what you said before. Like, what are the big names in coaching anymore that would go over, that would go there? Like, maybe what is it, D'Antonio from Michigan State, or Tom Herman? But he just went home to Texas, so why would he want to go to Alabama? Like, there, you know what I'm saying? There's not a lot of the age of the legendary football coach is dying out. Urban is gone. Les Miles at Kansas might be forgotten very quickly.
Right. I mean, these guys that have been around for a long time, that era is almost over.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Harbaugh, good Lord. Harbaugh is one of the more overrated coaches in college football. So that's not going to happen. Maybe Chris Peterson at Washington, maybe David Shaw could go over to Alabama. I don't know, man. Like, I'm kind of excited to see it. Because Saban's got to call it quits eventually. He's, what, 70 years old?
He's 67, and I would imagine, you know, 5 to 7 years at the absolute most before this thing is over. I mean, it feels like it's coming at some point. And there were the rumors that he flirted with the Giants a year ago, so you never know when that could pop up again. And maybe he wants to try to go out and spend 3 to 4 years maybe chasing a Super Bowl in the NFL. Like, you never know. But he's certainly the clock is ticking, rather, at Alabama. There's a name you didn't say there that, I mean, this is pure speculation, but I'm connecting some dots, and I feel like Jimbo Fisher could make some sense at Alabama before long, because his AD just left. The guy who hired him a year ago gave him that ridiculous contract, $75 million guaranteed, is gone. He's gone to LSU. Now, most people are saying, well, could LSU finally get their man, you know, in Jimbo eventually, you know, depending on what happens with Ed Orgeron. Ed Orgeron's got a great team this year. Who the heck knows how that's going to pan out in the coming years? But Jimbo may say, do I need to jump at LSU, or can I wait out Nick Saban and can I go take Alabama? I mean, Jimbo's won a national title. He's one of four coaches active who's won a championship. One of them is Mack Brown. So basically he's one of three coaches who's won a national championship active. And he coached under Saban. He has modeled his program as much as any coach in the country after Saban, and has had success doing it. It feels like that one, and money would be no object for Alabama to pay whatever the buyout would be to make sure, you know, he gets his money from A&M, that whatever's left on that contract. I don't know. I just, because there is no obvious name, no younger coach that's kind of on the rise. I mean, Chris Peterson is one that kind of makes sense to me, only because of his success, but when he's a Northwestern guy, I don't know that he wants to jump into that kind of that silo of that you would call Tuscaloosa. Jimbo Fisher is a name that I actually think would make some sense.
Yeah, and I didn't consider that because of that. What was it, 10-year deal?
Yeah, 10-year, $75 million.
Rich kid, Lord, I get it from his standpoint. Like, it's $75 million. Go get your bread, but. And I think it's all guaranteed too, but from A&M standpoint, man, you're paying this guy $75 million to get in a conference with Alabama, Auburn, and LSU, not conference, division, right, with those guys, plus the Mississippi schools who are, you know, sometimes they're usually average, but, you know, every like 4 or 5 years, they're excellent for some reason. So you got to deal with that every couple. You're going to have to deal with that cycle once or twice before you go. Arkansas is Arkansas, but like, that's a lot of stress, man. That's a lot of pressure at a school like A&M that is, for some reason, has the highest expectations despite the lowest possible production over its history. I don't know, man. That's a lot of, that's a rough situation to be with. I don't know if I'd be able to deal with Texas A&M for 10 years. So maybe that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where you go. And there aren't even really a ton of differences between A&M and Alabama in terms of, like, resources and money and pressure to win. The difference is Alabama's actually won. A&M acts like they're Alabama without actually being Alabama.
Exactly. No, that is a cult down there in Texas, man. I'm not a huge A&M fan. I haven't been since Sumlin. They had that 1 year with Johnny Manziel, and they've been filling themselves ever since.
Yeah, and I just wonder, you know, if we get – and again, Jimbo's only in year two of this deal, but if Saban's around for five more years, if Jimbo only has 3 or 4 more years left on that contract, all of a sudden that buyout's not as daunting for a school like Alabama that prints money. It would make sense. Now, Jimbo also will be pretty old at that point, and who knows who could emerge in the next 4 or 5 years that we're not thinking of right now. Herman's name is interesting if he continues to succeed at Texas, but he's at home. So, like you said, there's not an obvious guy. So it'll be interesting.
I'd be interested in where's Brett Venables going to be about when Nick Saban finally retires.
I wonder, well, you know Venables well. Do you think Venables still wants a head coaching job, or is he comfortable being paid $2 million a year?
That's the thing. I think that sports society and fans – and even media as well, they attach the desire to be a head coach to people. They're like, every assistant coach doesn't want to be a head coach, nor do they have to be. But you just have to wonder, okay, Brett Venables, if he's somehow still at Clemson by the time Saban retires, let's call it 5 years down the line, and you've been the number one option on everybody's list for 5 straight years, but then Alabama comes calling. We're not talking Kansas State.
Right.
This isn't Virginia Tech, no offense, but like Alabama comes calling and says, we want you to run the program. I don't know how that's hard to say no to, man. That's one of those, like, I thought Miami could be, if they went after Venables, I thought that would be hard to say no to as well. That's an elite program. And I don't know, man, that's something to watch out for. And Clemson fans listening to this might not like that, but you know, I dare you to tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I think it would be hard, and I mean, this is in no way, shape, or form a knock on Venables. He's been tremendous. I think Alabama fans would have a hard time buying into the idea of hiring an assistant. But if there's not a head coach that is willing to step into that fire, maybe they have to turn to a route like that. And if you're going to turn that to that route, Venables is as good as anybody out there. Another name that makes some sense would be Mario Cristobal. I mean, he was a part of that Alabama machine there for a couple years. He's up at Oregon. If he gets the thing rolling there at Oregon for, you know, a little while longer, they've been dominating recruiting now for 2 years. If that thing all of a sudden takes off, that's another one that would make a lot of sense. But that's years away from knowing if he's really up to the job. So it'd be interesting. I think the main takeaway is Dabo's at Clemson for a long time. They're going to win championships at multiple, probably in the next 5 years. And as long as Trevor Lawrence is there, they're going to be set. They should probably win it again this season, if we're being honest. So I'm glad you could hop on. I do got to let you run now, Marcel. We'll talk Panthers again at some point on the radio, but as far as this podcast goes, we'll keep it strictly to Clemson. And if I ever need an Arizona State insider, I know who to hit up too.
Absolutely, man. I got you on the ASU. I'm here for the Herm Edwards hype.
Hey, you and I might be the two biggest Herm Edwards fans in Charlotte.
You know that's my screensaver, man. You know that's my lock screen.
I've seen it. I've seen it with my own two eyes. All right, man. Hey, I got to let you run, but I will. I'll catch up with you soon. Appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on.
And now it's time to welcome onto the podcast from the Orlando Sentinel and Tribune, Matt Mershell, national college football writer over there, has a very good Q&A up right now with Justin Fuente from Virginia Tech. As soon as I read it, I knew this was a guy I wanted to get on the podcast to kind of take stock of the Hokies as we get ramped up here. The spring football is over. We're trying to look forward to summer, really starting to look forward to the fall. Of course, this is going to be a pivotal season for Virginia Tech. So Matt spoke to Coach Fuente recently, and I wanted to get Matt's thoughts on that conversation and the Hokies in general. Matt, how you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing today, Josh?
I'm doing fantastic. I know, you know, you guys have a great podcast, Gridiron 365. You guys over at the Orlando Sentinel, you just started ranking every team from how many teams? I don't even know anymore. I know more about college football than 99% of the country. And what is it, 130 now?
Yeah, it's 130.
Okay.
Now.
All right. So I was right.
Liberty just moved up last year to become, and I think this year they're the full-time status. So it's 130 teams now.
I used to be able to tell you, you know, every single stadium, every town, every conference, and now there's been realignment and teams moving up to FBS, moving down to FCS. I'm starting to lose track. I'm still I got the Power Five, I got the MAC, but you start getting into these like the Sun Belt now and these other conferences. They're just changing so much. Matt, I'll be honest, I can't even keep up with it.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty good with the teams and the conferences and stuff. It's when we start getting into stadiums because, you know, they're new rights deals.
Oh, my
gosh.
New
sponsorship. And, you know, I sometimes still make the mistake of calling stadiums back from the day when I grew up. Joe Robbie, for instance, was I used a couple times once. And, you know, things like that. And I get corrected, obviously. But it's you never can keep track of all that stuff. But, yeah, it's there's a lot to mention, especially now with 130 teams.
I blame EA Sports. If I still had NCAA football, I would know everything. That was how I knew college football growing up. I could tell you every stadium, all that stuff, because I used them all in the game. Now we don't have the video game. Maybe we'll get that back sometime soon. I know we got a little sneak peek of that a week ago with Madden. But let's talk about some actual college football for a minute. So you spoke, Matt, to Coach Fuente recently. The Q&A is up on your Twitter page. I'm going to be tweeting it out as well after the podcast. But what was the vibe that you got from Fuente? Because this is going to be an interesting year for him.
Well, I think the vibe was he seemed very optimistic. You know, when I got him on the phone and we started talking, you know, one of the things I asked him kind of was, you know, what was your message following last season? You know, here you're coming off, you know, the first losing season in quite some time, 1992, in fact. They didn't play well. They had some moments there. I think when you look back on that season, I think that Old Dominion loss in week three was just crushing for them. And you know, so I asked, you know, Justin, like, what were you going through? What was your message? And he seemed pretty optimistic. You know, he talked a little bit about this idea that they just need to kind of refocus, you know, look at everything overall as a program. He said he sat down with all his coaching staff and they evaluated every part of what they were doing, looking at the weight room schedule, working about running, you know, out, you know, how they do their running drills. He talked about how some of the coaches' meetings are run, those kind of things. You know, he felt like he wanted to make sure that every bit of the program and the process was evaluated. And he said he felt like after they got it, were all said and done, they felt like they really kind of made some corrections and felt like he think everything was really good. He uses a great reference where he talked about when they got on the practice field for the first time in spring, it almost felt like when it was over, like he'd just gotten through a shower and it felt like he was kind of able to wash away all the badness and negativity that came from last season. So I think that he feels like this team can definitely, you know, take some steps forward from what and learn from what happened last year. But he also knows there's a lot of work that lies ahead for the Hokies.
You know, he is such an interesting arc at Virginia Tech because, you know, he takes over for Beamer, who the program had obviously taken a backslide in the last few years in the Beamer era. It wasn't what it was in the early 2000s. But the group that he inherited when he first got into Blacksburg was a pretty good group. He had Cam Phillips and Isaiah Ford, and he had Bucky Hodges. And even on the defensive side, he had some great leaders, some older guys like the Woody Barons of the world, Greg Strowmans, and guys that were – there was actually a really talented group. They had recruited fairly well in the one or two classes there right before Fuente arrived that were upperclassmen when he got there. And so he was kind of able to sustain – you know, he brings in Gerard Evans at quarterback, and that kind of helps stabilize the gap. They go to the ACC championship game. And it almost feels like – last season, he was a victim in a certain way of his own early success because he dealt with last year what a lot of coaches deal with in their first year or two is that turnover of the roster and going through a lot of maybe a culture change of sorts. You know, the people I've talked to in Blacksburg who are close to the program have said that they lost a lot of the leadership that they had those first 2 years going into last season. They also lost some guys to some suspensions and being kicked out of school that they were counting on defensively that all of a sudden now they're going to have to play these younger guys. So it felt like last year, you almost have to view that as like a year one. I know that people aren't going to look at it that way, but Fuente actually now, I think last year, I think was the bottoming out. Now he's got a lot of these young guys that I'm sure he's excited for what they can do now. And in a lot of cases, their second year on the field.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think, you know, he really kind of inherited a lot of veterans, a lot of holdovers from, you know, Frank Beamer's last couple of years. I think that helped them out. You know, and Justin's done a great job. You saw what he did at Memphis. You know, he's worked with quarterbacks. He's worked with offenses. I think the offense kind of got a spark under him. You saw that in his first, you know, two seasons. And I think last year was interesting. I ended up speaking to Justin before last season. He was here in town for a Nike coaches clinic. Sat down to him for about an hour. And we talked a lot. He said he had some concerns going into last year, you know, that he felt like they were at some positions they were going to be really thin. You look at wide receiver, he felt like they needed more experience in some of their areas. They lost some guys who left early to go to the NFL, you know, trying to get the NFL. He He felt like some of those guys, if they had returned, might have helped provided some of that veteran leadership that maybe they were lacking last year. So he went into the last season, I think, kind of expecting maybe a little bit of there to be some bumps. I don't think he thought it was going to be nearly as bad as it was. But again, when you've got young players, you got guys you're trying to bring along, it takes time sometimes to get some of that growth. You saw issues at quarterback, obviously. You know, a guy like Josh Jackson, who looked really good his first year, his freshman year, really, you know, got hurt and dropped off. Ryan Willis comes in, you know, and then now, you know, you look at the defensive side of the football, they gave up way more yards than they have in a while. Bud Foster's defense, it was very untypical of a Bud Foster type defense. And then, you know, now you come off of that year and you look at the fact that this is a team now that's got, I think it's maybe, last I counted, was maybe a dozen players in the transfer portal who have transferred or in the transfer portal right now. So there's going to be some turnover. I think there's going to be some elements of guys who leave there that maybe weren't on board with what Fuente's trying to do. So there's going to be a little bit of a change there. But I think now that they've gone through this, I think maybe this can help them out as they get prepared for this upcoming season.
You know, and kind of along those lines, when you talk about guys leaving the program, you know, it's never good to lose talented kids. But I think sometimes we on the outside, or especially fans, they almost treat it like it's a video game, to make another NCAA reference. They treat it like they just see, oh, okay, this guy was a four-star recruit, or this guy, you know, was a talented receiver or tight end or defensive line, whatever, and they don't have any idea or any understanding of what that player's fit was like from a cultural standpoint. Was he on board with what the team wanted to be about? And if they weren't, sometimes that can be addition by subtraction in a way, is you lose guys who, for one reason or another, aren't bought into what you want to do. And that can be hard, especially in a case like last year where some of the older guys on that team probably weren't bought into what Fuente wanted to do. And he trusted some of the younger guys. And he's got a really good core of young guys now that it feels like they're going to be able to build. And the Coastal's going to be in a bit of flux as well this year. We're going to get to that in a couple minutes. But with that in mind, what do you make of Fuente's, I don't want to say job security, because I don't think he's on the hot seat per se, but last season was the worst year on paper that Tech has had in 25 seasons, so fans are restless. What do you make of where Fuente sits right now? What does he need to do this year to calm whatever fears that the fan base in Virginia Tech might have?
Well, I think what's going to have to happen, you know, is that they're just going to have to perform better, especially on the defensive side of the football. He's in an awkward position a little bit there when you look at the fact that, you know, again, he inherited Bud Foster. He kept Bud Foster on as defensive coordinator. We know what Bud's been able to do over, you know, his time at that program. They need to get better on the defensive side. Now, whether that includes, you know, I think they can, because a lot of those guys who were young and inexperienced last year now had a year under their belt. I think that will help them get better and grow. I think because of what happened last year, I think you're going to see more of a focus on maybe trying to create more turnovers, to limit the turnovers they have. You know, you look at their schedule. I mean, their non-conference schedule is really not, you know, it's not that tough outside of a game in November where they travel to South Bend to take on Notre Dame. They've got Old Dominion, Furman, and Rhode Island. So those are games that else should be winnable. And as you mentioned a little bit, you know, the Coastal is not a division. I think this year it's going to be, you know, one of its strongest. I think there's it's pretty much up for grabs who could be there as well. So I think there's an opportunity there for him. I think what they have to do is they have to identify the quarterback, whether it's going to be Ryan Willis or someone else. I know Braxton Burmeister gets there. Mm-hmm. He's a lot of talk about him. I think it's going to end up being Willis, although, you know, Fuente would kind of, you know, lock in that he's definitely his return starter. And I think they just need to continue to do what they've been doing. Hopefully, as you mentioned, with some of these guys who've left, maybe you get rid of some of the negative element that was on the team that could help you out, that maybe won't pollute the system. There's some guys there that maybe weren't a good fit. I think also, too, when teams go through rough times, I think you find out the guys who are really willing to stick it out and work harder and try to get better. And you find the guys who aren't, guys maybe who aren't willing to stick it out, guys who are kind of start complaining and things like that. So I think some of those guys will move on. I think eventually things will even itself out. I agree with you. I don't think he's on the hot seat. I think, you know, again, though, if they can get back to a bowl game, if they can get, you know, 6, 7, 8 wins, maybe get to a bowl game, win a bowl game, I think things will start to right itself. I think also, too, that'll help strengthen recruiting as well.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I think outsiders' perspectives are always the most fair and the most objective. And we, college football fan bases across the country, can live in a super insular world. Like you get in your own world and you have these unrealistic expectations, and a lot of times it's what perpetuates this coaching cycle and teams, and or not just teams, but athletic directors maybe pulling the trigger too early on coaches because of unrealistic expectations that fans have. You're talking about 6 or 7 wins there. I think that the fan base would probably be up in arms if that were to happen again, even though realistically that's probably, I mean, an okay season for this team and this roster. Where do you view Virginia Tech nationally? Like what, give me like 2 or 3 programs that jump to your mind. When I say Virginia Tech, who's on that same plane? Who's on that same plane as Virginia Tech in terms of where they stack up nationally in 2019?
Well, you know, man, that's tough.
And I mean programs. I don't mean like teams this year who's going to win 7 games. I just mean like the prestige of the program. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the prestige. I mean, I still think Virginia Tech is a prestigious program. I think anyone knows has ever been to Lane Stadium knows what it's like. I think you've seen, the program get there as well. I would think at some point, maybe not what's happened recently to Florida State. I think Florida State is a big, is a program much like Virginia Tech is, I mean, when you look at the big picture. I think also when you look around, I'm trying to think of, and maybe outside of like in the SEC, maybe you'd look at, you could even say even the Florida, in my backyard, I mean, that kind of prestige, you look at what they've been able to do over the last couple of years. But every program, I think, goes through these kind of ups and downs at times, and it's always cyclical, it's not like something that always continues to go down.
Yeah.
I think that, for Justin, I think it's just one of those things where, you're going to have these periods of maybe having a down year and then maybe hope looking to bounce back. I still think this is a team. I mean, I'm throwing it out there. I mean, there's a team that could be ranked, at some point at the end of the year, when it gets down to it, depending on what happens. I mean, like I said, their schedule non-conference wise outside of Notre Dame is relatively easy. Their conference schedule, except for a road game at Miami, and we're not sure what Miami's going to be like, and maybe at Georgia Tech. Again, looking at what, new coach there with Jeff Collins, it's going to be interesting to me to see. I think there's an opportunity to make a big statement there. I think they have to start out really hot and then go from and then move on. But I still think Virginia Tech's a national brand. From a guy looking at it from Florida, I mean, I look around. I always consider Virginia Tech one of the better programs when I look at college football, especially in the ACC.
That's interesting to hear. Yeah, because I wonder. I'm so close to it. It's so hard for me to look at it objectively. I mean, I grew up a mile from the stadium. I went to games for 20 years, so I don't want to be the guy trying to toot the horn of Virginia Tech and say, oh, look, it is on the level of the Florida States and Florida's, like you said. I personally look at them more like Wisconsin or like Iowa, Oklahoma State, like those programs that it's like, okay, you're a big brand. You're not, like in Oklahoma State's case, you're not Oklahoma, you're not Texas, okay? Or in Wisconsin's case, you're not Ohio State, you're not Michigan, but you should expect to win 8 games minimum every year. Now, I know Virginia Tech went through a period where they won 10 games for a long time with Beamer, but I think realistically speaking, like those programs all should be 8-win programs. They should be in bowl games every year. Maybe once in a blue moon, you just take a step back and you have an off year. And that's what it was for Virginia Tech a year ago. I mean, I don't get the sense. Michigan State's another great example. Michigan State's a program that's been – Mark D'Antonio is doing now more or less what Frank Beamer was doing 20 years ago, where he had a program that was a good program from a smaller college town, not a blue blood. And all of a sudden they were nationally relevant every single year in the top 5 or 6. So it feels like that's kind of the ceiling where Michigan State is now. That's what Virginia Tech's ceiling could be. And I just wonder how patient the fans will be. Michigan State had an awful year a few years ago. They went, I believe, 3-9, 3 seasons ago? They've bounced back perfectly fine. They won 10 games again a year ago. TCU with Gary Patterson, who coached with Justin Fuente. Fuente was his offensive coordinator a decade ago. TCU took a step back early on in the Big 12. They even had one down year, I think, a couple years ago as well, and they've rebounded fine. So sometimes it's just a matter of getting the right quarterback, getting the right personnel, and it's just really, really hard, even for the good coaches, to sustain and do what the Beamers of the world did and win 9-10 games every single year. It unless you're Saban or Dabo Swinney or a handful of coaches, that's asking a hell of a lot. With that in mind, what do you make of the Coastal this year then? You touched on a couple of those teams there. Who in your mind, because you're ranking all 130 teams, I'm going to ask you to rank these teams in the Coastal right now. Who do you think is, Matt, would be your favorite in the Coastal if you had to pick one right now?
You know, when I look at the right now at this situation, I think the Coastal, to me, I just still think Virginia Tech might be the favorite going into this.
Yeah,
I mean, I that's what I mean when I was talking about. I think when I look at overall, I don't trust Miami. And I hate to say that because, again, we're from the state of Florida. But when you look at what Miami's gone through the last couple of years, they're a very uneven program. You know, you saw the transition in the offseason. Mark Richt leaves. You know, Manny Diaz, I think, is a good move. But do they have the talent to come back and be a contender in the Coastal? I think you have to think that maybe Miami might be there at some point, whether or not that's true or not. And then maybe Pittsburgh might, follow as in the third spot, for me, just based on what they bring back. I know they won last year, but I thought last year that kind of came out of the blue for me. Yeah. I didn't see them kind of being that kind of a type of team. And then I think, Virginia's kind of bouncing back a little bit, having kind of a moment. You look at what they've been able to do with Bronco Mendenhall with that program. To me, that's has been impressive as well. And then, North Carolina, I think, is going to have its time and bounce back as well at some point under Mack Brown. I don't know if it's next year, but I think they'll have that. So to me, those are kind of the hot teams right now in the Coastal. I mean, that's why I think Virginia Tech is right there. And I like your analogy. I think they very much fit when you mentioned Iowa. Iowa, to me, this is what this kind of program fits as well. You know what I mean? Like, it has that where year in and year out. And it's unfortunate that we're now in the day and age where it used to be guys could get a 5-6 year deal. They were locked in. Fan bases gave them that kind of time to have an off year, develop and recruit. Now you don't get that. You don't even get 3 years now. There's guys who've only been, get 2 years and then they're out the door. That's amazing to me. It's disappointing as well, because you'd like to see a guy like Justin maybe get at least 5 years to get some classes in, get 6 years, get some more of that talent developed in. You want to see some of these guys get that opportunity. They just aren't. I think athletic directors are more willing to kind of pull the trigger. I don't know if that's the case at Virginia Tech. I think there's going to be a little bit more patience and let things kind of go, seeing this as maybe a little blip on the radar in the big picture of things.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, unless they miss out on a bowl game this year, which seems almost have to try to miss a bowl game with that non-conference schedule you talked about. I mean, it feels like they're going to at least get to 6 wins, even worst case scenario. So if that happens, I feel like you got to give him a longer leash than that. And along those lines, the quarterback position is going to determine the Coastal. I mean, all of these teams have, not all of them, but most of them have questions at quarterback. I mean, Bryce Perkins coming back at Virginia is probably the most talented or at least most productive quarterback in that Coastal division. I mean, Daniel Jones is gone at Duke. Miami, I mean, who the heck knows what they're going to end up doing? Is it going to be Tate Martell? It sounds like he didn't have a great spring, so we don't know if he's solidified himself as the starter. You would think he's the guy, but it could end up being N'Kosi Perry. Georgia Tech making that change on offense, a complete wild card. So, I mean, I think, like you said, it's up for grabs. And if the quarterback position pans out at Virginia Tech, if Ryan Willis plays, takes a step forward, even a small step forward, or if it ends up being Burmeister, maybe Quincy Patterson, if he can figure out the quarterback position, I think this is a golden opportunity for Virginia Tech to capitalize on a weak division and basically wash away, take a shower of 2018 and just move on from it. I think that will be it won't be that hard to do, but the quarterback position is going to determine everything, not just for Virginia Tech, but really for the entire division because these teams are so close. Matt, we got to run, man. That was awesome. I really appreciate it. Of course, you guys can check out Matt's podcast. He does work for the Orlando Sentinel and Tribune, but also podcast is Gridiron 365. It's on iTunes. It's available on Android as well. Matt, I'm looking forward to your countdown, man. I'm gonna memorize those 119 through 130 teams. I know you're starting all the way at the bottom, but this is gonna keep you going, man. If you want that college football fix, I feel like this is gonna carry you now for the next 3 months.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, we started in mid-April, and it goes all the way down to the day of the first games, which is Florida Miami, on the kickoff here in Orlando. So it gives fans, I think, an opportunity to kind of a little bit of college football in the desert of the summertime when you're looking for something to kind of whet your appetite there.
I need it like I need air to breathe, man. I got it bookmarked. We're going to be checking it out every single day, looking for the next team. So Matt, appreciate it, man. We're going to do this again soon for sure.
All right, sounds good. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's College Football Country. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. Guys, there are only 4 months until football. We can make it. We do this together. We'll talk plenty more football as we get closer. Next week's episode, just around the corner. Going to drop these every Wednesday for you guys, maybe even Tuesday night if you're lucky. But, of course, thanks to Marcel. Thanks to Matt for joining me today. And until next week, we're getting closer. We can do it. Hang in there.